Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, trying to make sense of our time. So who better to do that with than historian, author, editor of White Flight from Princeton University, Kevin Cruz. Thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Charlie.
Okay, I'm just sitting here looking at your Twitter feed because that's how I prep for these things. And you just tweeted a little while ago something from Dan Scavino, who is Trump's guy. And it's this video of a dancing Donald Trump at what, Great America or something?
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell?
I mean, when I saw that video, I thought it was actually the Democrats had done it, and Scavino had tweeted it out by mistake. It doesn't really do much for the president, I don't think, other than just kind of it's a theory that, you know, the Trump administration's operating philosophy of conservatism is whatever owns the libs, right? You know, and that's what they want to do.
Well, I'm definitely owned. So where shall we start? Hey, it's happy birthday to Jimmy Carter, who, I never thought I would say this, is looking a lot better all the time. As right. You pointed out, here's a president who actually took the emoluments clause seriously. That seems so last century.
Right. They gave up the peanut farm and factory. And again, you know, I wrote a piece on this there's an edited collection called Presidential Misconduct that was an update of something that came out. It was originally done for Watergate. Nixon resigned before the book could come out, but we updated it for this year. And I had the Carter chapter, which was a pretty easy one to write. Not a lot of bad stuff happened under Carter, but still, he had a special prosecutor looking into his family's farm's loan, suspicious loan there. And he testified for Congress about that. Senate inquiry into his brother, Billy Carter, and his family's business dealings. So this is what presidents should expect. And Carter knew it and put up with it. And yet Trump acts like someone looking into all of his shady dealings is it's somehow the worst thing that's ever happened to a president. It's par for the course.
It is. So let's start talking about, start off since we're in the trying to figure out where we're going to land in history. President tweeting out about civil wars. Now, in fairness, what he's quoting this pastor who was on Fox News, because of course that's where he gets all of his information from.
Of course,
saying that he was afraid that if they impeached and removed the president, it would lead to a fracture like the Civil War. Now, of course, in civil wars, Americans kill one another. So are we at civil war levels of division? And what's behind this narrative that seems to be, it's kind of a popular narrative among some of the bots and some of the fever swamp dwellers out there that, you know, we're about to split off into red versus blue, hot war.
Yeah, but this is something that we've seen before, right? I mean, not just in the actual Civil War, which, as you know, was an incredibly bloody and destructive affair, obviously, but during Nixon's impeachment. A lot of his partisans said, if you impeach the president, you're going to tear this country apart. It's going to lead to chaos. We're going to be at each other's throats. And so we've heard this kind of rhetoric before. And this is, of course, rhetoric that we know, or I believe we know from the investigation into the Russian troll farms, as something that the Russian social media folks were pushing, that there'll be a civil war in America if the president's held accountable. So this is a popular theme on the right. What really struck me as odd about the Civil War comments is it's rare to hear the president talk about a civil war coming. Usually a civil war is waged against the incumbent power. Somebody breaks off from that. And rather, he was proposing, or at least Jeffries was proposing, that if the government holds him accountable, according to the constitutional means of impeachment, that there would be a civil war, that it would rip the country apart. That's a weird thing to hear coming from inside the White House. And also, we should note that Jeffrey's comment about, you know, if the president is removed, that would spark a civil war. You can only remove a president with a 2/3 vote in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to have at least 20 Republican senators vote to remove the president for it to happen. So it would, by definition, be a bipartisan act. So if we do reach that point, and I think it's unlikely, but if we do reach that point of removal, that's about as far from a divided country as you could get. It would be Republicans and Democrats alike coming together to say it's time for the president to go.
You know, I'm torn between thinking that this is a typical Trumpian just silliness and sort of just roll your eyes versus thinking that there's something potentially ominous and dangerous about the president throwing out images like that. You know, we used to, you know, conservatives used to say that ideas have consequences, words have meaning. That was all pre-Trump, by the way.
Right.
But you know, we have seen how unbalanced people out there, and it doesn't take a large number of them, read this stuff, take it very, very seriously, and might act out. And so
I think that's,
the level of irresponsibility is kind of breathtaking.
Yeah, I think it really, a president really has to watch his words. And I wrote a piece about this in the New York Times earlier this summer about his rallies and how they reminded me of George Wallace's rallies, in which you, in both cases, had individuals inspired to act on them. And a political leader can't be always held accountable for everything their followers do, but they should take every precaution not to encourage the crazier ones out there. We have examples of followers of this president who have tried to commit acts of violence. We had Cesar Sayoc, who was a regular Trump rallies, who mailed off pipe bombs to the president's enemies. The president has to know that if he talks about civil war, there are some people who aren't going to take that as a metaphor or take it as a far-fetched warning, but are going to take it as a literal call to arms. And that's something that's incredibly serious.
Well, let's talk about the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr. Bill Barr is said to have urged foreign governments, traveled around the world, foreign governments to aid in the probe of the CIA and the FBI. Really does seem to be buying into some of these, the conspiracy theories, about the origins of the Mueller investigation. This is the Attorney General of the United States. So we're not just talking about Donald Trump making some phone calls here and there. This is not a one-off. We're not getting a larger picture of all of the president's men. There's a phrase for you. You know, all the president's men who are part of this. So, Give me your take on Bill Barr and what he's turning out to be.
Well, it really is alarming. This is not the role of the Attorney General. The Attorney General isn't the president's personal fixer. He's not supposed to be a Michael Cohen type figure. We've seen attorney generals in the past do this. We saw this with John Mitchell under Richard Nixon. We saw this with Harry Daughtry under Warren Harding. Notably, both of those attorney generals wound up in trouble with the law. Mitchell went to jail. Daughtry only escaped jail after two hung juries. So this is not a good model for Bill Barr to follow. But it is something that I think fits a larger pattern with what Bill Barr has done. Remember, he was attorney general before and in the Iran-Contra scandal. And William Safire called him the cover-up general for his role there. So this is a role that I think Barr finds himself happy to take, to be kind of to not be, as the role is, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States of America, but rather to be the president's kind of personal fixer. And that's an alarming thing to do. And one, again, if you look back to history, doesn't end well for the Attorney General.
Yeah, we were having a discussion about this last week, and we were trying to come up with, you know, who was who, you know, Watergate figures, who was this person in the current scandal, and I just threw out that Rudy Giuliani might turn out to be Martha Mitchell.
Yeah,
not everybody gets that reference, but you kind of remember Martha Mitchell, who was married to the Attorney General, and she would every once in a while spout off and say, yeah, they all knew it and everything, and people thought she was kind of nutty and crazy, but it turns out that, you know, she was the one, the voice out there, the kind of a little bit unhinged voice out there that was actually telling what was going on.
Yeah. No. I think that's absolutely Martha Mitchell. And you know, we have that video of Rudy Giuliani and Trump where Rudy was dressed up as a woman. So maybe he'll be happy to play the part of Martha Mitchell.
Okay, so Rudy Giuliani, what is your take on this? I think that Rudy Giuliani poses a real danger to the president, and everyone in Trump world, with the exception of Donald Trump, seems to recognize this, that he is dangerous. Now, he's going on television. I don't know whether or not he's drunk or just addled, but he is prepared to throw anyone else under the bus, including, you know, Mike Pompeo. He's almost literally the definition of the loose cannon. I mean, just rolling around, you know, several tons of iron, just rolling around the deck, wiping out everything around him. But you know, he was, of course, subpoenaed yesterday. How significant is that? Do Democrats really want Rudy Giuliani to be testifying in front of a House committee?
I think the Democrats are divided. I personally think they should have him testify because Giuliani keeps trying to clear his own name, and he does it in weird ways. First of all, as you know, by implicating other people.
Yes.
He really seemed, he's like Samson trying to bring the temple down with him. If he's implicating Pompeo and Barr, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more to come. Last night on Hannity, he said he has videotapes and cassette tapes and recordings, and you know, God knows what he's got. And again, he thinks he's going to exculpate. He's bragged about the text on his phone. He's you know, you don't often volunteer that kind of evidence, but he's apparently got it. And so the Democrats have subpoenaed him. He seems to think that he has an option to avoid the subpoena. I don't think that's true. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm not sure Rudy is either, now that we think about it. But he had said several times on TV that when he was doing all this work for the president in Ukraine, that he wasn't acting as the president's lawyer. So he seems to have waived any kind of attorney-client privilege there, and is, I think, ripe for the plucking. I don't think executive privilege is going to protect him either. They'll huff and puff about this, but I do think he's going to either have to testify or pay some kind of price for this.
You had a funny tweet. You said a couple of days ago, Rudy is a day away from turning over a cassette tape of his confession and some notarized photos in a manila envelope with the word crimes, all in caps, scrawled across it on magic marker. And then, of course, a couple of days later, he goes on Fox News. And it seems to imply he has videotapes and tape recordings of something, and who knows what that actually is. But this certainly is an element of entertainment. So as a historian, as you look back on this, and you mentioned Harding. This Ukraine story, or the Trump story, is like what in American history? And let's put it in impeachment, since we do, you know, that narrows the field. Yeah. Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton. What are you thinking about these days in terms of historical parallels?
Honestly,
if there are any.
I think I don't know if there are any anymore. We are so far off the rails here. I mean, it's certainly. Compared to Clinton, this is so much worse. Clinton, brought up for perjury, for lying about the affair and obstruction of justice, which again, once upon a time, Lindsey Graham thought was an incredibly serious crime, and now he's saying that he doesn't care about obstruction of justice at all. So we're far beyond what happened with Clinton. I think we're well beyond what happened with Nixon and Johnson as well. You know, the Nixon, the charges he was brought up on were breaking into the DNC, which in his case was done physically. Here you've got allegations that Trump had done this electronically with help of Russian aid. But then the real thing again is obstruction of justice, and there was serious charges of that. We've got those detailed already. In the Mueller report, we've got 10 instances there. We're seeing more and more every day. I don't know why the White House staff hasn't taken away the president's phone yet, but between him and Giuliani, they're adding more and more to the eventual articles of impeachment on obstruction of justice. And I think we're getting to the point now, if the president does try to root out this whistleblower who is protected by law, if he tries to root out the identity of this whistleblower, we're going to have something akin to Andrew Johnson's violation of the Tenure of Office Act, which is what got him. And also Johnson was brought up for just generally being abusive, that he was saying mean things about Congress. Ultimately, he was a drunk. There was a lot of that.
And a horrible person. I mean, he really was a horrible person.
He was a horrible person. Yeah. But so if you lump together the stuff that both Nixon and Andrew Johnson were brought up on, I think that the case against Trump is much beyond that. So I think we're kind of. We're beyond the historical precedents here for impeachment.
This is an interesting point. I mean, let's just talk about the whistleblower and the attacks on the whistleblower. You know, on one level, it doesn't make any sense at all, because the credibility of the whistleblower isn't really at issue here. The whistleblower turned over other information which can be either corroborated or followed up on. Turns out he nailed his description of that July 25th phone call. So the whole point seems to be intimidation is to be sending a signal to other people who might be willing to speak out or be whistleblowers. Don't count on the federal law that's supposed to protect
right.
you. You know, if you break bad on me, I'm going to destroy your career. I'm going to out you. I'm going to destroy your life. We're coming after you. I mean, there's no question about the agenda here. And I don't know whether or not that's an impeachable offense in and of itself. But it's certainly an indication of why this impeachment inquiry is necessary when you have a president who behaves this way. No, when you go back to, but I've been trying to play this and reading up on the various historical parallels. The problem with the Bill Clinton impeachment was that the underlying crime just struck people as too trivial, that you're right. Just not going to throw a president out of office for getting a blowjob in the Oval Office. It was right. Just too small. And so yes, he lied about it. Yes, he tried to cover it up. But I think that people make a judgment about the underlying issue. You know, was it worth it? And Nixon was largely about the abuse of power to cover up a crime, you know, a serious crime. But your point that this goes beyond this, what Trump has done, the underlying issue is really fundamental. It is the extortion. It is putting national security at risk. It is using the power of his office for his own personal benefit on the international stage. There is really no historical precedent for that. There's no parallel.
No. And to back up a little bit to your point about the whistleblowers, I think one that we shouldn't let go by. I do think it's important, first of all, that the whistleblower's identity is ultimately irrelevant. The inspector general reviewed the charges, found them credible enough, investigated them, passed them on to Congress. The acting DNI said he found them credible. The White House's own transcript that they released, their own edited transcript, confirmed a lot of these things. So it's not a question of whether the whistleblower whether it was hearsay or anything like that. We've got the proof there. I do think the real thing here, though, is that they're trying to intimidate future whistleblowers. And we've got another one coming out apparently about the handling of the IRS and the president's financials and tax returns there. But there's another whistleblower there who's coming out. And Democrats haven't quite acted on that with as much speed, but there are probably others on the way, right? And it's fascinating for me as someone who studied, conservative politics for the last 50 years, to see the party of law and order become the party of, snitches get stitches. It really is amazing that the president has openly talked about he doesn't want people squealing and rolling over and he did this with Michael Cohen and he's doing it now. And it really is alarming. And I think this, as you note, is why an impeachment inquiry is really important, because I think it'll blow a lot of those secrets finally open.
Okay, now I'm working this through, so feel free to slap me down at any point on all of this. Up until now, the conventional wisdom is it's always the cover up. It's not the crime; it is the cover up. And last week, every major newspaper in America had the word cover up in the headline because the details of that July 25th call with the Ukrainian president were put into a much more secure server, which was clearly an attempt to hide the information. Right. But what strikes me is that the cover up, to the extent there was a cover up, has been spectacularly unsuccessful.
Right.
In part because the story, Trump's attempts to intimidate an ally into helping him dig up dirt on a political opponent, has been playing out in real time. And this is one of the striking things about the scandals of the Trump era, that they don't really try to hide it. It's in the public record. As I was reading through the whistleblower report, you see the number of times that Rudy Giuliani, said the quiet thing out loud in May.
Yeah.
He's giving interviews basically saying that this is what he's going to do. The president is tweeting out, criticism of the Ukrainian president. It's a matter of public record. Now, there are some things that we did not know. We did not know about the president's order withholding the Ukrainian military aid. We didn't know the specific mm-hmm. details of that call, which we now have. But to a certain extent, the focus on the cover-up and the process, I think, is a distraction from what you and I have just been talking about, which is the underlying substance is wow.
Right, right. And I think it's natural for the press, for the public, to seize upon the cover-up, because it's such a clear sign that there was something wrong.
Right,
right?
It's a consciousness of guilt.
If you're trying
guilt,
to hide
right.
it, you yourself yeah. know it's wrong. You don't have to debate the underlying act.
Correct.
If you're trying to hide it, if you lock up these conversations in a top-secret server and hide them away – you've clearly got something to hide, right? But that, as you note, doesn't change the fact that what they're hiding is actually really bad. And normally we would say that the cover-up is worse than the crime. This is certainly true of Clinton, right?
Right.
That the underlying crime, there was no crime. It was a consensual sexual affair, but he lied about it under oath. That was the problem, right? Here, however, the underlying crime is, I think, much worse than the cover-up. So we do need to focus on both of those.
Well, and I do think that we're going to be getting, we're in an era. I saw your colleague Julian Zelizer tweeting out that this is feels like what it must have felt like during Watergate as things were coming out. Actually, I think that the pace makes it even worse because of the news cycle that we're living in. But you do get the sense that shoes are dropping on a regular basis. So, for example, you know, we find out that the report that from the Washington Post that during the Trump's meeting in the Oval Office with the Russian ambassador the day after he fired Jim Comey, that he said, yeah, and by the way, we don't really worry about interference in our elections because everybody does that, right. which is in itself extraordinary, but raises the question, how many other conversations were there, and are we going to find out what is in those conversations? I am fascinated to see the actual word-for-word transcript of that conversation with the Ukrainian president. Because if the summary was bad, you can just imagine what the actual word-for-word transcript will be. And I wonder how many other of these readouts that we're going to get and that we're going to see, and whether or not, you know, you are going to have more and more whistleblowers who are willing to come forward, which again goes back to this issue of why they're trying to intimidate them. Because you really get the sense that this is going to be a target rich environment.
Absolutely. And a lot to say that, first of all, as you know, what we've already seen, what the White House released on Ukraine is bad enough. And there's a lot more that they didn't release on that. We also know that there are conversations with Russia, with Saudi Arabia in there too. Russia has apparently declared a veto that we don't get a look at what's happened in these conversations without their approval, which again doesn't suggest they're very good. So all that is in there. And more as the administration turns on each other, as Rudy is aiming at Pompeo and Barr, and they're all going to be looking to save their own skin, you're going to start to see, I think, more and more people who have been holding on to dirt come forward, if only to save themselves, right? As I said on Twitter, if you're a criminal defense attorney in Washington, D.C., stand by the phone, because a lot of people are going to be calling you in the coming weeks looking for representation, because it's all about to hit the fan, and they all should start looking out for themselves if they haven't yet.
Well, and then, of course, John Bolton is out there as well. I mean, there are a lot of former national security aides who are free agents right now. Dan Coats, for example, is out the door. And my guess is that Dan Coats, you know, under the right circumstances, would have a lot of very, very interesting things to say, and would be quite candid about it. You know, who knows where John Bolton is going to go? Oh, so you mentioned the issue of, you know, the how people should be, you know, standing by the phone, the criminal defense lawyers. But given the fact that the Department of Justice is a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump Incorporated, who do they actually have to be afraid of? I mean, who would actually prosecute these things? You know, even in, you know, with evidence of flat out perjury, is the system going to operate?
That's a great question. You know, in Watergate, it was the special prosecutor Leon Jaworski, right, who brought a lot of these guys to justice, and we Mueller has been retired. You could always see the House authorized someone new, I suppose. Again, I'm not a lawyer or a constitutional expert, so I can't speak to that. You've got the different state attorney generals have been active in a lot of these cases. You could see the Southern District of New York ramp up again. There are a lot of authorities out there beyond the DOJ. And if the DOJ has abdicated its usual responsibilities and are instead serving as the president's defense counsel or fixers, you might see other people step up here.
Okay, so there does seem to be a little bit of irrational exuberance that Republicans might break with Trump. I mean, we have seen their unwillingness to do that so far. Also, Trump has something that Richard Nixon never had. He has this media ecosystem, which is prepared, ready and prepared, fully operational, ready to push whatever counter narrative that he wants. So I've asked this question before, if Richard Nixon had what Donald Trump has right now, would he have survived Watergate?
I think he might have. And again, that was the lesson. You know, we forget, you know, Roger Ailes was working for Nixon at the time, bemoaned the lack of a right wing media outlet to counterbalance the mainstream media. And he created it himself. And so I do think that Fox News and its the people in its orbit can do a lot to rally the base here. But even on Fox, you're starting to see some cracks here. You know, Chris mm-hmm. Wallace has been aggressive
in
pushing back against the administration spokesman. Shepard Smith hasn't been buying this. And we're starting to see if there's a civil war taking place right now, it's between the news side of Fox News and the opinion side of Fox News. And it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. But even if Fox News does wind up rallying around the president and rallying the base, I don't think that protects all Republicans. I think you're going to still see people who are from less than blood red districts really have to pay attention to what's going on outside that bubble, or it's going to cost them their own careers. They're going to go down even if the president doesn't.
You know, the fate of Fox News obviously is incredibly important. You know, if in fact you do have that kind of have that division, but I was really struck over the weekend watching the Kevin McCarthy's and the Jim Jordans and the Stephen Millers and their performance, and I think it's dawning on people how weak the defenses are right now, that virtually everything they have. All of their counter narratives have been falling apart. And I do think that's relevant. I mean, part of me has become so cynical that then I think I said on television the other day, you know, it's naive to think that the facts will determine the outcome of this, because in our tribal world, people will just simply line up on whatever side they are. But it is, this really does test this new system, the new Trumpian world, that this was the best they had to come up and say, well, the whistleblower is just hearsay. Well, yeah, but it's been confirmed. I think we're also going to test the willingness of other Republicans to beclown themselves in the way they did on Sunday.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's clear that the branch that those guys climbed out on is a very rickety old one and could break at any moment. And what was remarkable about the defense that they all tried to wage this weekend wasn't just how bad they all were individually, but how they were all, none of them really on the same page. For all the talk about the talking points and the White House trying to orchestrate a defense here, they really weren't that well coordinated. And so it was really kind of stunning. And I do think more and more people are watching those who go out there and try to defend the president for this are taking a beating. Not just in those interviews, the media has finally, I think, learned to really push back. You know, Jake Tapper mm-hmm. pushed back hard against Jim Jordan. Chris Wallace did a fantastic job against Stephen Miller in his presentation. But they're also realizing that at the rate at which new information and new scandals are coming out, that they could wage a defense of the president, and within minutes, it could be contradicted by the evidence that comes out. So they really don't want to be left kind of holding the bag for the president. And that's an important turning point here. That's when, you know, Clinton lost some of his diehard supporters when it was clear that he had lied to them. Nixon lost the final Republican holdouts when it became clear that he had been lying to them. As Republicans in the House and Senate realize that Trump is looking out for himself only and has been lying to them, as it seems, they're going to be much less forthcoming in trying to raise a defense for him. They're going to want to defend themselves, and I think rightfully so.
But by now they know that, right? I mean, they know this guy lies.
You'd think so.
They know this. But, I mean, it is interesting because they do know that they could go out, they could spend, you know, 24 hours basically saying, you know, this is absolutely not true. This is absolute fake news. And the president might just step out and say, yeah, I did it. So what? I'm thinking we need to have a moratorium on the quote about standing in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shooting somebody and getting away with it. I think that's old. I think it ought to be changed where I can get on the phone call and shake down a foreign president to dig up dirt on my opponents, and I will get away with it. Yeah. I mean, we are really at that level of absolute brazenness. Okay, let's talk about the Democrats, because it almost feels as if they've become invisible at the moment because of all of this. And so that race is frozen. Joe Biden, of course, one of the you know, one of the lines that might have some political resonance, at least among conservative circles, is that this is really about the corruption of Joe Biden, because Joe Biden's son was getting $50,000 a month from this Ukrainian energy company, which looks incredibly swampy. I mean, there's really no way to say that that doesn't look bad. It's certainly not criminal. Nobody says it's criminal. But talk to me about how the Democrats are handling this, because obviously there are some Democrats that are, you know, sitting back going, hey, if this takes out Joe Biden, I'm not too sorry about that.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, the Democrats are working in two levels now, Rob. So we've got the Democrats in the House who are, I think, have finally, it's like the moment in the Wizard of Oz where they realize they had the power all along and they're finally using the tools of office. And I think the people who put them into power in the 2018 elections have been praying they would finally use. And they're discovering that, you know, the seemingly invincible Trump machine really is folding pretty quickly as soon as the slightest pressure is applied. So that's one level in which Democrats, I think, have really stepped up. And that's going to, I think, probably occupy our attention on the Democratic side for the time being, even though you've got a presidential race going on. The Democrats, I do think there are some who would be happy to see Joe Biden be taken out over this. But I think that they are smart enough. Maybe they're smart enough. Some of them have been. I know Cory Booker has to push back on this, realizing that any kind of smear that's made against Biden at this point would just be a prelude to a smear against the eventual Democratic nominee. So they can't sit back and watch Trump take out their opponents because they know it's going to come for them. This is something that I think the Republicans didn't really realize in 2016 when they were up against Trump. They kept on sitting back, you know, kind of smiling. You know, Cruz would smile as Trump took out Rubio and on and on.
Right.
And they were happy with that. They didn't realize that eventually the alligator is going to eat you. Right. So I think the Democrats might be a little more forceful in pushing back on this. It's still a long way away in the presidential race. I think we're going to see we'll know something soon after Iowa, but certainly not before. Any poll up until Iowa is virtually meaningless.
What should Joe Biden do? There's obviously a difference of opinion on that. There are folks who think that he should come out and very, very forcefully defend his son, push back against this, give a checkers-like speech. Obviously, they've decided not to do that, or at least to wait. But there's clearly a real risk to Joe Biden that he could, because this does look swampy, and because you can just throw up so much dirt, and you know what the Trumpian fog machine can do to him.
Right.
So how much danger is he in, and should he be responding more forcefully?
I think it's again. I'm not a campaign consultant, but this is my free advice, and they're free to take it or leave it. I do think at some level they have to punch back on this, because you've had enough people, both in the Ukraine and the U.S., who have looked at this and have said, actually, what Biden did was going to increase scrutiny of the company his son was in, that he, along with the rest of the Western world, was calling for the removal of a prosecutor who was not investigating corruption enough. And they wanted a newer prosecutor who would actually dig into these things more forcefully, even if that meant greater attention to the company that Hunter Biden was involved in. And I think that's actually you've got enough people in the Ukraine and the U.S. who can vouch for that and make a strong case for it. The misstep they've made, I think, was when they said that cable news outlets shouldn't have Rudy Giuliani on anymore unless they provided equal time. If I'm in the Biden campaign, I am driving Rudy Giuliani to the studio. I would put a microphone in his front yard. You know, let him speak as much as possible. He is not helping the president here. I understand why they feel upset that he's telling lies about them, but I would let him speak as much as possible, and then balance it with you know their own pushback.
Yeah, there's a good adage in politics that when your opponent is digging himself into a hole, you just, you know, don't interrupt him. Just let that play out. There will be plenty of moments for him to do it. And I haven't seen any polls suggesting that this has hurt him yet. You just don't know. I think the real danger is in a general election where Trump, who is, let's face it, there are some things that he's good at. And one of the things he's good at is projection. Whatever he is accused of, idea, he will just simply turn around. Well, no, you are the puppet. No, you are the swampy yep. one. No, it's your children who are out, pillaging right. the world, on your name.
How is that a line the Trump team is pushing? That a politician's children are profiting from his office. How is that something the Trump team is pushing?
It is so brazen. It is like, okay, what is the ultimate? What is the ultimate triggering of the libs?
Right.
Let's just turn this around. You do wonder whether or not voters just simply roll their eyes about all of this. So, that is the problem. Okay, so I can't remember whether the last time you were on the podcast we talked about Dinesh D'Souza.
Oh yeah, we did.
It continues to amaze me. I guess the psychology. I'm now more and more interested in psychology rather than ideology. I'll be honest with you, and I mean that straight up. How Dinesh D'Souza is a intelligent man, right? Well educated, and yet has fallen into this weird vortex of bullshit. Here's the psychology. He's caught basically peddling bogus history. Completely, and you have just demolished him. And yet he keeps doing it. Now, is that simply the economic model, or is there some sort of psychological denial? Whatever happened to people just being embarrassed and saying, hey, I screwed up. I'm going to do better. My bad.
I think he's incapable of doing that. I don't know if it's psychological or economical, but we've seen that he's incapable of really doing this. He had a video out a while back where he said, he picks these weird narrow terms and tries to extrapolate from them. But he said in 1860 there was no Republican who owned slaves, and if they can prove me wrong, I'll have to retract that. Well, historians quickly, I and some other folks noted that there were Republican slave owners in 1860. One of them, Francis Blair, presided over the Republican National Convention in 1856. He was a Republican delegate to the convention that nominated Abraham Lincoln in 1860, and he owned a lot of slaves. There are a bunch of other slave owners from Kentucky and Missouri and the other border states. We clearly showed this. D'Souza's response wasn't to say, I'm wrong, I'll back down. It was to say, I was technically wrong on that one point, but my larger argument is correct. And he's tried to keep spinning and spinning. And again, I think it's just that he's got too much of an economic motive here, that people are willing to pay for his speaking tours or buy his books or his movies or whatever. And so he's wedded to this.
No, I think you're right. I don't think this is a psychological issue. This is an economic issue. He can't give up his grift, and he's counting on the fact that the people who believe his history don't actually know any real history. And so they live in that alternative reality. But it is extraordinary to watch. It is amazing to watch what these guys are capable of doing. And also, I think the ethos that we're living in now, which is that never apologize, never admit you made a mistake, continually double down.
Right.
And this is one of the ways in which Trump has changed the culture. Trump's obviously a product of the culture to a certain extent. And, originally conservatives basically said, we get who he is and we just want the judges and everything. But watching how many of them have modeled their behavior on some of the worst aspects of his character is truly remarkable.
It really is. And it's something we have to remember, it was there from the start. People announced the Trump campaign dead on arrival in the summer of 2015 when he mocked John McCain, when he said he liked soldiers who weren't captured, right? And everyone expected him to have to back down and apologize for that. And he stuck to his guns and he doubled down, and his base loved him for that. That he refused to say he was sorry. He refused to say he was wrong. He still hasn't apologized for the birtherism. He hasn't apologized for getting the Central Park Five stuff wrong. They were exonerated by DNA evidence. He still refuses to admit he was wrong. And that, I think, is something that a lot of people in his base really admire. And as you note, other Republicans have taken note of that and are following that course.
Kevin Cruz, thank you for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast and giving us so much of your time. Appreciate it very much.
Always a pleasure, Charlie. Take care.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.